This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. You may have heard a feature story on air last week from Farah Yousry, health equity reporter for Side Effects Public Media, about growing divisions among school leaders and parents during the pandemic. We're now joined live with Farah to talk more about that story and to find out what she heard in her weeks working on the feature. Welcome back to the program, Farah.
Thanks, Miriam.
How did the idea for this story come about?
Yeah, so the idea started when I saw a video of a physician at a school board meeting here in Mount Vernon, Indiana. He was very eloquent, used scientific terms, and, you know, felt legit. He was talking about COVID, vaccines, and masks. But after journalists and medical experts checked, turns out part of what he was saying was, in fact, misinformation that could discourage people from getting vaccinated or having kids wear masks at school. Still, the video went viral in a matter of hours. It was picked up by some national media, as well as other social media accounts. It got millions of views in a matter of days. And that's something very extraordinary for a school board meeting, let me tell you that. I mean, typically just 10 to 15 people attend school board meetings. Things are very low-key. But recently, school board meetings have been looking like battlegrounds. Hundreds of people and protesters show up in many of these meetings across the country with big flags and signs. School board members are sometimes attacked and verbally abused and intimidated. And so I felt that school board meetings now are turning into a place where, you know, people can spread health misinformation, a place where people take their political frustrations and really hurt other people who normally would just be their friends or next door neighbors, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you mentioned how these are usually low-key meetings, but now I guess, you know, there's public comment time. I'm assuming that's when folks can just say whatever they want to say without anybody checking them. What was that experience like for you to just go from a low-key meeting to one that was a lot more active?
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising, very surprising. And usually those school board members are, you know, they're unpaid volunteers. They're elected by the community. They represent the school district they live in. They're nonpartisan and non-political. You know, these races are not partisan. And so usually school board members are former teachers, parents, grandparents, you know, sometimes university professors who study education or public policy. And so for them to be faced with this kind of rage and anger and, you know, aggression, I mean, it's something for sure. It's out of the ordinary.
Yeah, and as you're bringing up that point that they're nonpartisan, they're volunteers who are, you know, taking these positions, running for these positions, that must be pretty tough. I mean, and I'm wondering if a lot of folks may not even realize that there's somehow, you know, if somebody gets voted into something, there's an assumption that they're part of, I don't know, the system in some way. Mm. So what is the role of a school board member?
Yeah, so normally school boards have 5 to 9 members, and they base their decisions on input from the superintendent, from families, teachers, students, and the general community. And they're usually in charge of discussing issues like budgets, school policies. So these are people, like you said, who took it upon themselves to be in this position to do their civic duty and what's in the best interest of the school kids in their communities. And for sure, there could be some of them who are taking this position as a stepping stone into a career in local or national politics somehow. But that's absolutely not the common scenario. Most of them are not concerned with ideology or politics when it comes to their roles on these boards.
Well, we've been hearing about, you know, school boards all across the country and even here in the state becoming combative. What is the fighting generally about?
You're right. So school board meetings are becoming very combative. And you can have a taste of that in this coming soundbite, which you'll hear is a video uploaded on Twitter from a school board meeting in Tennessee. Protesters are surrounding the car of one of the speakers at the meeting and threatening him.
Stuck in that factory. How you like that?
We know who you are. We know who you are.
Keep it calm.
No more masks.
Keep it calm. Keep it calm.
No more masks.
We're on these guys' side. They're
on
our side.
No, they're not.
Yeah, so you can hear, like, we know who you are. We know where you live. We're not on the same side, you know. So these are, like, small communities which are, I mean, they're close-knit. These people are neighbors and friends, like I said before. And so as for what the fight is about, it's mainly parents objecting to COVID safety policies and specifically kids wearing masks in schools. And the reason they're fighting with their local school board members about this is that as of now, there are no federal or state mask mandates in Indiana and in many other states. And so what the CDC and health departments did was they issued lots of guidance and information recommending masking up in schools, but not mandating it. So now what's happening is that health departments are saying this is going to be a local decision and school boards will be tasked with it. So now school boards are finding themselves in the crossfire. They need to make public health decisions in the middle of a raging global pandemic. And they need to do that as masks have become such a divisive issue now. You know, some parents don't want the school boards to require students to wear masks, no matter what the infection rate is. And so they're showing up at these board meetings. And I have to say, some of them are respectful. They're there to deliver their point of view. But others seem to cross a line. And I spoke with many board members from different states, and they tell me they get hate mail, threatening calls, and even people showing up at their doorstep. And that's been a recurring scene across the country, not just in Indiana.
And that's got to be tough to deal with, because you want to make the right decision for your school environment, but you also have to balance, I guess, you know, the parents and stuff. Well, we do have a soundbite you got from the Lafayette School Corporation. Can you help set this up and who we're going to hear from?
Yeah, so this is Les Huddle. He's the superintendent of the Lafayette School Corporation. And he told me it was much easier to require masks last year when there was a state mask mandate.
I'm not sure if school corporations are in a winning situation. You know, you try to approach problems and look for a win-win solution. Again, with the opinions and, you know, we can all find our own facts. We can all find our own medical experts to support or not support our side of masks. It just comes down to that there is no win-win situation. This is a win-lose for some people.
That's a powerful statement, that there's no win-win. It's a win-lose for some people.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sense of people don't feel they're on the same side anymore, you know, and it's taking this fight is taking on more meaning. It's not just about public health anymore. For some people, it's about politics, you know, and so that's making the role of these board members all the more harder, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a sense of hopelessness, and it seems like these fights are not going to be resolved in these meetings. Is that the impression you got, or does it seem like there's common sentiment that this is just not going to be resolved?
Yeah, absolutely. But again, I need to point out that almost all of the school board members and superintendents I spoke with would talk about how hard the situation is, but in the same breath, they would be saying that they know that they have this responsibility and they took this responsibility and that they're bent on doing the right thing no matter what for the sake of the school kids. And in some states like Florida, for example, where the governor there actually banned mask mandates, the school board members of some districts defied the governor's order and required masks because they felt it's the right thing to do. But then school boards are finding themselves entangled in all these political and legal battles in the middle of a pandemic. So that's definitely changed the nature and role of school board members.
Have you seen this before, this kind of backlash towards school board members with other divisive issues?
Yeah, so school boards have had to weather similar heated debates before, like school prayer in the 1980s or sex ed in the early 2000s. And I spoke to several public policy professors who say that heated debates are not new. But what's different now is that political tribalism in the U.S. is at an all-time high. Add to that social media with all of its misinformation, and really you have yourself a perfect storm. You know, it's also important to point out one more thing. The COVID-19 pandemic is evolving and changing rapidly, and so is the guidance coming out of the CDC and health departments. And there's also an influx of small scope studies from across the world. So there are studies, for example, in Israel that say masks may not be so effective for kids, but then there are other studies in the US that say masks are important. So, you know, parents are understandably very confused and concerned, and some of them, frankly, also are very political, and mask or no mask is becoming a different debate for them. That's no longer just about public health, but some sometimes conspiracy and politics.
Right. And sometimes too much information is not a good thing, it seems like.
Exactly. Yep.
Well, we have a soundbite from Charlie Wilson, a school board member since 2007 in Worthington, Ohio, and the past president of the National School Boards Association, talking about elections, I believe.
I'm just surprised at how many people I hear from who have been board members for a long time who said, it's not worth it. I'm going to either resign or not run again this fall. And also, even more unfortunate, some people are running for single purpose reasons, not because they want to improve this, but they've got a single issue, whether it be critical race theory or masking or in-person learning or whatever.
So it sounds like this is like the new battlefield is a school board. Mm.
Yeah, and exactly. It will have an impact on elections. Some long-serving school board members like Charlie are saying that it's becoming so partisan that any decision they make is deemed political, and it will definitely anger one group of people. And so, you know, also many parents are not shy to say that they do not trust the CDC or any government health authority. And, you know, it's making these board members in a very difficult position. They have to fight a legal battle as well as a health battle in the middle of a pandemic, you know.
Right. And again, just worth mentioning, I think, is that these board members are volunteers. This isn't a paid job that they're doing.
Exactly.
And so as we get ready to wrap up here, are you hearing anything about solutions to these meetings getting so heated or these fights? Is there anything that can be done?
Well, as of now, there seem to be very little common ground, honestly. And with the Delta variant, the stakes are a lot higher now. The virus does not wait until we settle our differences, you know. And Delta is much more transmissible. Infection rates are higher. And so, you know, school board members are trying to do the right thing. But, you know, there doesn't seem to be like a solution that will make everyone happy at this point.
Right. I mean, I wonder if a mandate would solve things if the governor just came through with a mandate.
Some school board members say that. Again, they don't want to set the precedent that, you know, the federal government or the state would impose something on the school boards. But in this exceptional situation where it's a public health, you know, crisis that no one has seen something like it before, they say it might be reasonable if the state or the federal government would do that at this point.
Right. Well, thank you so much. Farah Yousry is a health equity reporter for Side Effects Public Media. You can find her recent story and all her work on sideeffectspublicmedia.org. After a quick break, we'll learn about the incredible life of J.B. Stratford, the son of a former enslaved African American who graduated from Indiana Law School in 1899 and went on to become a key figure in Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. J.B. Stratford, the son of a former enslaved African American, graduated from Indiana Law School in 1899 and went on to become a key figure in Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. With us now to talk about his story are Nicole Burtz, an alumni of Indiana University's Robert H. McKinney School of Law, and David Shahid, a retired Marion County judge and also an alumni of the McKinney School of Law. Welcome to both of you. Nicole, when you first heard about J.B. Stratford, what was that like?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting story just about alignment and how things came together. I happened to be doing some research about the Red Summer of 1919. And as I was researching and reading different things and really trying to track down different narratives and oral histories that had been passed down among different African-American families, I happened to stumble upon this brilliant podcast, Dreams of Black Wall Street, formerly Black Wall Street 1921, hosted by journalist Nia Clark. And I just happened to be listening one day and I was driving and it was mentioned, along with J.B. Stratford being one of the fathers of Black Wall Street, as well as a survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, that he was a graduate of the law school. And as an alum myself, you know, I have this moment where I pull over and I rewind the podcast to make sure I hear everything correctly. And it's just been, you know, mind-blowing tracing his history and his journey and his life. And especially as we are coming, or we've arrived at the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre, and seeing the things he was able to do with his life and just studying it.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that gives me chills just thinking about listening to the podcast and then finding out this is somebody who went to the same school you're going to or you graduated from. So that must have been a really amazing experience.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, David, what about you? How did you initially learn about JB?
Yes, I was doing research on a presentation, and I can't really remember what the presentation was about, but Nicole heard it through a podcast. I was just reading stories or some narratives over the computer, and saw the name J.B. Stafford in a story about Tulsa and the race massacre and what he had done. And there was a brief mention about Indiana's College of Law and him being a graduate of that. And so I found that ultimately remarkable because I'd never heard about J.B. Stafford before. And I, at that point, wanted to just verify if that was in fact, true.
And Nicole, what stuck out to you about him when you first started learning about his life?
Yes, I think, several things, but really just truly a remarkable life. You think about this man, J.B. Stafford. His father was born into slavery. He learns how to read and write from his owner's daughter, who, according to his descendant, his late great grandson, Judge Cornelius E. Toole, was an abolitionist. Once the father learns to read and write, he spends his time in the field, pretending to work, but he's secretly practicing reading and writing. And then he develops the skills necessary to forge his owner's signature on a pass, which allows him to escape and gives him, the permission and mobility to leave the plantation. And he leaves and goes to Stratford, Ontario, and claims the variations of the city's last name and, truly begins to build his life and legacy. So, you think about just the time period, too, of American history we're thinking about and living through. A man whose father was born into slavery, who escaped slavery. J.B. goes on to distinguish himself in so many ways. Not just a pioneer, but we're talking about a lawyer, an African-American lawyer during that time. What he's doing in real estate and development and so many things he's involved with. He's truly a civil rights advocate and lawyer before such a term even exists in our country and in our history. So, just the remarkable things he's able to do. And then he builds this, along with many of the other business ventures, one of the most noteworthy, he builds the Stratford Hotel, a 68-room hotel, which is the nicest and largest owned African-American hotel in the country at the time. And so just thinking about his roots and how he starts and how all this is taking from him in the Tulsa race massacre, just really a heartbreaking story. And then to continue to rebuild, and then with the legacy of his descendants, with many of his family members go on to do, which we can talk about a little bit, and also just how his family, you really talk about the resilience of this Stratford family and lineage who fought so hard to not only preserve his name and his legacy, to clear his name, but to go on to be pioneers and do wonderful things within their own right.
And that word resilience is exactly what I was thinking. It's just remarkable resiliency, just learning about this story through all the odds, being able to be so successful. David, were you surprised that you didn't know about JB's story before you found out about it?
Well, it was obvious that the Tulsa Massacre of 1921 was meant to be written out of history. It was one of those unfortunate pieces of history that I think in retrospect, people were ashamed of and embarrassed about. And so that's why the story really wasn't told. But I have to, at this point, take this opportunity to thank Dean Bravo at the McKinney School of Law and her staff, in particular Patricia Kinney, for supporting us in trying to verify that J.B. Stafford was, in fact, a graduate of the law school. And because we wouldn't be talking about this if they had not been generous in time to research and find out and verify that he was, in fact, a graduate of the law school in the late 1800s, in the late 1800s.
I know we're going to talk about this probably a little bit later about when they finally cleared his name in the late 90s. But I guess what I'm wondering is if folks knew about this story in the late 90s, is it just now being talked about in Indiana?
Yes, absolutely. Early in the late 70s, his grandson, Cornelius Toole, who was a lawyer in the Chicago area and later became a judge, sent a letter to the dean of the law school based upon the memoir of J.B. Stratford. Unfortunately, it was not followed up on, but last year I was looking back at my notes, and in August of last year is when I got verification from the Lilly Library that they had done research and found in the archives that J.B. Stratford was a graduate, that he had attended the law school, that he had taken the bar in 1900, passed the bar, and was licensed to practice law in, the, in 1900 in Indiana. So the information was there, but there just had to be the diligent inquiry to verify that he was connected with the law school and with Indianapolis.
If you're listening to the program and have a question or comment for our guests, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Nicole, what records are there out there about JB's life? I know David mentioned a memoir.
Yes, so there's a memoir, you know, held in the family of like a very sacred text. And, you know, I even remember reading this article in the Smithsonian Magazine, and I love this quote by Nate Calloway, JB Stratford's great-great-grandson, but he refers to it as, it's like the family Magna Carta or Holy Grail or Ten Commandments. And, you know, just that power of what this sacred text means, and that JB transcribed it into 32 written pages, and it's been handed down to over six generations. And, you know, I think what's also really important here for me, along with the resilience, oftentimes when I think of oral history, you know, so often oral history has been frowned upon, or, you know, it doesn't hold the same weight and magnitude of if you have physical history or, you know, things that you can archive. And oftentimes within the African-American community, so often how we find out our history, right, and how we get to stories about J.B. Stratford are these oral histories being passed down from one generation to the next and being kept sacred and being told and making sure the next generation doesn't forget the shoulders that they stand on.
Right, exactly. And so this is another way, I guess, for the family to keep the memory alive.
Absolutely. But as I was but back to what's out there, you know, there's the manuscript held by the family. But the other things I think I was able to find that were really exciting along my research, you know, there was a point, kind of just how I came into this, after I heard and I was doing research on my own, I actually reached out to the law school, as Judge Shaheed mentioned, reached out to the director of the law library. And they actually thought that I was connected to Judge Shaheed in this project. And I had, you know, I didn't have prior knowledge of this project he was working on. And so they sent me the information they had in the correspondence. And I actually ended up reaching out to Dean Patricia Kinney, the Assistant Dean of Diversity and Inclusion at IU McKinney, because we had a great relationship when I was a student. And I really felt like if IU McKinney didn't have the knowledge, if this was something they knew about J.B. Stratford's life and him being a graduate of the law school, this was something they would definitely want to be involved in. And when she and I had the opportunity to talk, she informed me they had already formed the committee and they hadn't even had their first meeting yet. And that's how I joined. So when you just talk about total alignment and things coming together, you know, definitely one of those moments, Judge Shaheed and I were working on this at different points and not contacting each other, and everything was coming together. But things I was able to find, you know, the Black press, the historical Black press really aided me in trying to put together many of the pieces of JB's life before I was able to confirm various things. So our local paper here, the Indianapolis Recorder, the fourth oldest and largest African-American newspaper in the country, was really helpful. They covered JB's life, covered things about his son, C.F. Stratford, the Chicago Defender, as well as the Tulsa Star. The Tulsa Star had so many wonderful things I was able to see in terms of the hotel ad. Even when J.B. Stratford would write back to the Black citizens of Tulsa, informing them of different things that were going on when he would visit various communities or initiatives or things such as the Stratford Library. And so I was really aided by the Black press for sure. And then Oberlin College Archives, they were really helpful with, you know, J.B. Stratford graduated from Oberlin College and many of his descendants continue that educational path after him. And there were so many things kept in that family file of their time at Oberlin.
That's amazing, and I'm really inspired by the passion you both have for looking into this history. And David, JB graduated from Indiana Law School in 1899. What do we know about what Indianapolis was like at that point?
Well, I think that's an important question, because I think what we really learn and why this kind of history is important is the context, because there's an important case most lawyers know about is Plessy v. Ferguson, because most of your listeners are probably not aware of segregation and the law of separate but equal. But in 1896, there was Plessy v. Ferguson, which basically established segregation as the law of the land and separate but equal as the law of the land. But at that same time, I guess J.B. Stafford was trying to get into law school. He couldn't have gotten into law school in the South, but he was able to get into law school here in Indianapolis. He was able to attend school with other white law students. It was against the law in some parts of the South, but yet he was able to attend law school in Indianapolis. He was able to take the bar with other white lawyers or soon to be lawyers. And then he was admitted to practice. And so I think that's an important context to understand that even though separate but equal and segregation was the law of the land in Indianapolis, a black man who was first generation from slavery was able to go to an integrated law school, graduate from that law school, take the bar and become a practicing lawyer. Now, the other part of that context is that with segregation, there was the National Bar Association, which was formed because they could not be part of the American Bar Association. So it is important to look at the context of all these things, because Indiana, even though it has kind of a troubled history in some respects, in the late 1800s, J.B. Stafford was able to go to law school, get an education, and be trained so that he could go on and do marvelous things in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and also in Chicago.
And when we talk about Tulsa, Oklahoma, Nicole, why did J.B. move to Oklahoma?
Well, J.B. moved to... Can I just say one point real quick? I wanted to back up to Judge Shaheed's point. I think it's also important, you know, as we're thinking about the context and history of Indiana, just to put this in a larger framework, if we're thinking about, you know, a few years later in 1910, we have Madam C.J. Walker, who comes to Indianapolis and establishes and incorporates her company's, you know, headquarters and how all the black businesses that are also thriving along Indiana Avenue. So just thinking about the black history that told and untold that was happening in Indiana, specifically in Indianapolis at that time, that many people may not have extensive knowledge about.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I think we often gloss over that stuff and we don't realize just how big of an impact there was here.
Oh, absolutely.
And so, Nicole, when it came to his move to Oklahoma for JB, what prompted that?
Yes, well, you know, Tulsa was becoming known as a prosperous area for African Americans to resettle in and achieve prosperity and upward mobility. So you had many African Americans migrating to Tulsa at the time in the Oklahoma territories to, you know, have this economic independence and to build their lives and to have freedom and just a way to create their own lane.
And David, we know that Tulsa, Oklahoma was where it became known as Black Wall Street. What was JB's role in that era, and why was it so significant?
Well, he was one of the early pioneers in Tulsa. At one point, he had 15 rental properties. He had a 16-room apartment building that he owned. He built, from the ground up, the 55-room Stratford Hotel. He owned a drugstore, pool hall, banquet hall. Plus, he was a leader in the community, often quoted in the African-American press based upon some of his trips in various parts of the country. So he was a leader in every respect of the word, in every respect of the term. And in fact, his holdings in the Stratford Hotel alone at the time it was destroyed in 1921 was worth about $1 million. It was worth $1 million then and probably more than that in today's terms. So he was a true leader in the business community.
And wouldn't it be fair to say, I mean, he was not only a pioneer and a leader in the African-American community, but society as a whole. I mean, he was doing things, $1 million hotel, things that's huge at that time.
Yeah. One of the things that's interesting, and again, it's part of the history that's lost, but we're trying to, Nicole and I are trying to bring it back so that people can see it, is that the Greenwood community, Black Wall Street, as it was called, was such a thriving community primarily because of segregation that many of the white people borrowed money from business people in the Black Greenwood community.
Well, I definitely want to touch back on that after a quick break. We're speaking about the incredible life of J.B. Stratford, the son of a former enslaved African-American who graduated from Indiana Law School in 1899. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. We're continuing our discussion on J.B. Stratford, who graduated from Indiana Law School in 1899 and became a key figure of Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. With us again are Nicole Burtz, an alumni of Indiana University's Robert H. McKinney School of Law, and David Shaheed, a retired Marion County judge and also an alumni of the McKinney School of Law. Before the break, David, we were briefly getting into the topic about the Greenwood community and how folks in the white community were actually coming into the Greenwood community to take loans out. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. Because of segregation primarily, one of the reasons why many from the South migrated to Tulsa is because they could work in Greenwood, they could get housing in Greenwood, they could shop in Greenwood at all the stores and department stores and so forth. They could go to church in Greenwood. There was a school in Greenwood for all the children. And so it was a very wealthy community. In fact, it was probably the wealthiest part of Tulsa at that time. And so many white residents knew of the wealth and prosperity in Greenwood. And so they would actually borrow money from some of the successful people that were living in Greenwood, including J.B. Stratford.
I mean, it was a thriving community, quite obviously. And I wonder if that sort of led to some of its demise from folks who just didn't want to see that kind of success.
I think that's exactly correct. I think there was a certain amount of jealousy, and there was an incident that kind of triggered the massacre where there was some incident on an elevator, and it targeted a young Black man. The young Black man was later exonerated because it was an exaggeration. But that incident alone, and when the Black men of Tulsa came to the jail to try and defend the young Black man who was at the threat of being hanged or lynched, that caused a lot of the white men to become very aggressive. And so in the morning, they targeted the Greenwood community. And the rest is history in terms of the number of African-Americans who lost their lives. I think it was over 300. But the massive destruction of that Greenwood neighborhood. And J.B. Stratford himself was indicted. And it wasn't until 1896 by a governor's pardon that he was pardoned for being seen as an instigator of that race riot.
Right. And before we get more into sort of the race riots that happened, Nicole, what was J.B.'s role in the 1921 incident in Tulsa?
Yes. Well, according to J.B.'s memoirs and the accounts of his family and also just the overall accounts, you know, I would really like to encourage all listeners to review Events of the Tulsa Disaster by journalist Mary E. Jones Parrish, P-A-R-R-I-S-H. She lived in Tulsa, and you know, she gives these firsthand accounts of while Tulsa's being burned down and destroyed, all these things that are happening. And along with her account, she gives several firsthand accounts and eyewitness accounts and survivors who also talk about what's happening. You know, as far as because it was predicted that a young African-American male would be lynched in the community, how several of the African-American men in the community went down to the courthouse just to ensure that he would get a fair trial and, you know, that he would have his justice instead of just being lynched in the community. And she describes in great detail with her own eyes how the African-American men in the community were greatly outnumbered by these white mobs and how the mob grew from approximately 500 individuals to over 1,000, and how also many of the historical records, along with as Judge Shaheed touched on, because, you know, the Blacks in the community were so wealthy and had so much prosperity and nice things. There's so many firsthand accounts of them describing the looting, the burning, how they're seeing their possessions being dragged out of the home, how later on when they return the next day after their whole community is burned to ashes, how they're seeing those who were involved and community members wearing their belongings and having their items and, you know, laughing at them after this tragedy and almost unbelievable horrific nightmare take place.
And you know, it's interesting, I'm just thinking from my own perspective of growing up, I don't remember ever learning about this in history class, and I think it was in the last few years when there's been more light brought to this topic. It's such a shame, and it's such a dark side of our country's history. You know, what other significance does this Tulsa massacre hold in a broader sense, David? What does it say about where the country was at that time?
Well, I think it's very important that these stories be told, because it gives a, if we look at it, it's not just a story about J.B. Stratford, but it also is a story about America and how far we've come. At the very time in 1921, when this massacre took place, if we look in Indianapolis in particular and Indiana, D.C. Stevenson lived in the Irvington community on the east side of Indianapolis, and that was seen as the most powerful person with the KKK, as he was the Grand Wizard of the KKK. So there was, when you look across America, there was not just this hostility to African-Americans in Tulsa, but also in Indiana and also in other parts of the world. But nonetheless, there was an effort by many good white people to see that there was an injustice done. And that led to the pardon of J.B. Stratford and his family in 1996, a pardon by the governor, Frank Keating, and J.B. Stratford's family was there when he was exonerated and the pardon was given. So I think it's important to know that even though there were these ugly parts of associated with the massacre, there were people of goodwill and good intention that wanted to see that justice was eventually done to the Stratford family and to J.B. Stratford in particular.
Well, Nicole, what was your reaction when you found out, researching his history, that he was eventually pardoned in 1996?
You know, I think I had mixed reactions, truthfully. You know, on one hand, I think what's hard, especially when you read the firsthand accounts, for example, in the events of the Tulsa disaster, right? And they're so heartbreaking and it's so devastating. And it, you know, feeds into some of the overall very ugly stains of this collective history of the things that African Americans historically have endured. And on one hand, it was really devastating as you read about, you know, even up into his death. He was so bothered, rightfully so, by all that had taken place in Tulsa. And to take, and I think for me especially, one thing in particular, name and legacy mean a lot to me. And I think that's also why I've been so invested in this project, because, you know, when we leave this earth, our accolades, our awards, what we've accomplished, our wealth, none of that matters. You know, we take our name and what we've been known by, and referred to throughout this time. And so to have this stain on his life that was so false, I can only imagine how heartbreaking it must have been for him to endure that even in death. And then I think on the other side, I was just deeply inspired by the commitment and resilience of the Stratford family. Because, you know, there are various accounts you can read online. You can talk to the family, and just the commitment of this family to not only clear the name, which they did, but to continue sharing his story with the greater community and even within their family legacy, to make sure their descendants continue to know his history and their family origins, I think is such a powerful testament to the human will and spirit in general.
Absolutely. And if you're listening and have any questions or comments for our guests today, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Nicole Burtz, an alumni of Indiana University's Robert H. McKinney School of Law, and David Shaheed, a retired Marion County judge and also an alumni of the McKinney School of Law, about J.B. Stratford's story. David, J.B.'s ancestors have worked hard to maintain his legacy and tell his story. What kind of an impact do people like J.B. have on their descendants?
Well, I think it's really left to us to kind of see where things go from here. And I want to go back to a comment you made, and I share that same comment, is why we didn't know this history. And I think, again, it's important to reach out to Dean Bravo and Dean Kenny in terms of helping us tell this story. It goes back to, I think, a point that was made in the previous segment, and that is about political tribalism and education and partisanship. And that is that these stories are not told because a lot of times people don't want these stories told because they don't feel that they show their community in the best light. But I think it's important that we have Dean Bravo and her staff that are willing to face any kind of criticism to make sure that stories like this, which really talk about human struggle to be properly identified, are told. And so I can't thank Dean Bravo enough, as well as, you know, this program Absolutely. For making sure that the history gets out about someone who otherwise would be forgotten in history if it were not for the efforts of Nicole and the law school to make sure that this story gets out.
Well, is JB's story going to be pushed forward, for example, in the law school for law students to know and understand?
Well, I say for sure, you know, just as someone from the community, I think just overall, as Judge Shaheed has stated so eloquently, a huge thank you to our community, IU McKinney, Dean Bravo and Dean Kenny, you know, for pushing this effort. And I think, you know, this speaks volumes, not only to be telling the story of J.B. Stratford, but also when I think about my time as a young Black law student, thinking about if I would have seen the portrait of J.B. Stratford hanging up in the law school, what that would have meant for me, what that would have signified, you know, what that would have led to. And maybe I would have known the story a lot sooner. And I think one of the greater aspects of this, too, is J.B.'s story is not just an Indiana story. It's not just a McKinney story. You know, in so many ways, it's a greater national story. And Miriam, I think as you talked about, you spoke a bit about it being American history, and I couldn't agree more. J.B.'s descendant, Judge Toole, even wrote in his of Council Alumni News Magazine for North Carolina Central University School of Law during the academic year of 1996 to 1997, he talks about how this story of his descendant is an American story and how despite everything that was happening, J.B. had a great deal of faith and belief in the American system, you know, despite the defects and social afflictions. And I think in the grand scheme of J.B.'s family, just from a national level, for many of us who are African-American in this legal community, JB's descendants and JB himself, they're truly pioneers in the law and beyond. JB's son was one of the founders of the National Bar Association and one of the first presidents of the Cook County Bar Association. He was also one of the principal lawyers in the United States Supreme Court Hansberry Restrictive Covenant case. His granddaughter, Jewel Stratford, was the first African-American woman to graduate from the University of Chicago Law School in 1946. She argued before the United States Supreme Court, and she went on to become one of the first African-Americans and first women to serve as Deputy Solicitor General of the United States. So just, you know, beyond the direct blood lineage, this is a story for so many of us who stand on the shoulders of J.B. and his descendants, such as C.F. Stratford and Jewel Stratford, who have paved the way for so many of us within the legal community.
Absolutely. And it's like the legacy, I feel like, should be celebrated and talked about just as much as we hear about all these other famous family names, you know, that just become part of our culture.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Well, what do we know about JB's unpublished memoir? Has anyone outside of the family read it?
Not that I know of. I'm very grateful. A brief snippet about the law school was recently shared with me to try to, you know, confirm other additional points of the record. But it looks like the Smithsonian Magazine, when they wrote about the Tulsa race massacre, in a bit of the history, there are various small snippets included. But, you know, in a way, I love all the mystery around this memoir and that it's held within the family and that it's been passed down as this very sacred heirloom from generation to generation.
That's really cool. And David, what are you thinking is next for what you're doing with JB's story?
Well, one of the next steps is on September the 10th, there will be an unveiling of a portrait of J.B. Stratford that will be in the law school. And for me, that's a very personal accomplishment. I think that both Nicole and I feel very good about it. I know when I started law school in the 80s, there were no African-American portraits in the law school. And that was particularly significant for me because I can remember during my first semester, I had another law student as well as a law professor tell me that I didn't belong there. And it would have been comforting to see a portrait of an African-American who had been through those same halls and been able to come through those halls and be successful. So the fact that JB's portrait will be on display in the law school, I think will be affirming to someone who may have wondered if they belonged there in the future to see his portrait and say, well, if JB could make it back in the late 1800s, I think I can make it in whatever era I'm there.
Absolutely. And I mean, you obviously have made it and you've also paved the way for younger generations to come as well. And I think that's powerful that they're going to have his portrait there. Nicole, what does it mean to you to see his picture up there?
It means so many things. And I think many of the things it means is hard to articulate. I think definitely all the points that Judge Shaheed captured, certainly. But I also think for the future and the symbolism of what it means, right, to hang in the law school. But I think for the future generations of Black law students and diverse law students who will come through the doors of McKinney and see J.B. Stratford and learn of his life and legacy. I mean, that's an imprint you truly can't articulate in words.
And what's next for the JB story on your end, Nicole?
I don't know at this moment, but what I am excited about, as Judge Shaheed mentioned with the unveiling, just trying to continue sharing the story. You know, I think, as Judge Shaheed said, on the next generation, our responsibility. And so, as I mentioned, while I may not be a blood descendant, I take up the charge very seriously to continue sharing his story and his life and legacy and doing what I can to help make people aware of his life. And, you know, I really just want to encourage everyone to join us at the law school for the event on the 10th, which will be held in a virtual space. And you can go to the school's website at mckinneylaw.iu.edu to register. And we love as many people as possible to help us celebrate the life and legacy of J.B. Stratford. We're really excited that it's also being held on the 10th of September, which marks his birthday. So once again, the website is McKinneylaw, McKinneylaw.iu.edu. So I think just focusing all our energy and attention of still sharing the message, sharing his story, sharing his life, and also, you know, encouraging people to attend the event.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for your inspiring stories and the research that you're doing. And we look forward to speaking with you again in the future. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.